Good evening. Welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Among our stories tonight, after 3 days of hearings, the High Court reserves its decision on the citizenship of seven parliamentarians, but notes the need for an urgent ruling. What does it mean for the US to decertify the international deal on curbing Iran's nuclear program? And new Cancer Council figures suggest silica exposure is behind more than 230 cases of lung cancer a year, and it's mostly tradespeople on construction sites who suffer.
I'm not surprised because it's part and parcel of the industry. There's no real measures. I suppose because it's not something that kills you straight away, it's not on the big priority list. Falling objects are probably more likely to kill you on a building site.
It's now a waiting game to find out the fate of seven federal parliamentarians whose citizenship complications has seen them arguing for their careers before the High Court, sitting as the Court of Disputed Returns in Canberra this week. The Court has risen and reserved its decision after hearing arguments on whether any or all of the seven should be disqualified from Parliament for holding dual citizenship. Two of them, Greens Senators Larissa Waters and Scott Ludlam, have already resigned, but the others, including the Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce, are fighting to stay. Let's go to Matt Wordsworth, who is at the High Court this afternoon. Matt, firstly, we heard the argument from One Nation Senator Malcolm Roberts' lawyer as to why he shouldn't be disqualified. What did he say?
G'day, Linda. Well, Malcolm Roberts' counsel, Robert Newlands, was trying to argue two things, because, firstly, the government's Solicitor General has been trying to split this group into two smaller groups, five who were Australian citizens by birth, natural-born Australians, as they said, and then the other two, Scott Ludlam and Malcolm Roberts, who were naturalised citizens. And so Malcolm Roberts' lawyer said, well, that's un-Australian to make a discrimination between someone who was born here and born overseas. And the reason why the government's making that argument is because that means it would be more likely for those people to have some sort of suspicion that they may have dual citizenship problems and should have looked into it before they signed that nomination paper and perhaps offended the Constitution. But Robert Newlands said his client is actually in a better position than the others, because he said there was no problem with Great Britain being a foreign power back in the day in 1974 when he was given that certificate of citizenship. In fact, he's in the same boat, if not a better boat, than all the others, and all the steps that he tried to take later on were in the spirit of trying to renounce that citizenship, so he should be in the clear.
Okay, and there's fresh doubt over whether National Senator Matt Canavan is a dual citizen. What happened in his regard?
So his citizenship problem is with Italy, and the that's through descent. But the law is really complicated because it was only passed down through the father's line up until 1983, when the Constitutional Court in Italy revised the old law and said, no, it applies through the mother's line as well. And that's why Matt Canavan didn't realise that he was a dual citizen. And the expert report that his lawyers brought to court poured question over whether that Constitutional Court decision even applied. So they're saying there's a big grey area. One of the other lawyers appearing took issue with that, saying that happened really late in the case. No one really knew that that's what they were going to say. No one was there to cross-examine these experts. And to, when there's no one there as the contradictor, as they say, to question them, you can't claim victory if no one is there to fight what you're asserting. So that's something that the High Court's going to have to work out over the next few days as to whether even Matt Canavan is a citizen before they decide whether he has offended the Constitution.
Now, what's the argument for the remainder? Importantly, of course, that includes the Deputy Prime Minister, Barnaby Joyce, that they shouldn't be disqualified, or that they should be disqualified, sorry.
Yeah, well, there's two things. Firstly, the important case of 1992, Sykes and Cleary, over you've got to take reasonable steps to renounce your citizenship, whether any of these MPs did that. But there's a new novel principle that they're trying to read into the Constitution, into Section 44, and that is, if you didn't even know you were a dual citizen to begin with, then is it reasonable that you even took those steps to renounce? And so it comes about voluntary knowledge and whether, you know, they can then be deemed to have acted reasonably in the circumstances. And that's something that the High Court's going to have to read into the Constitution, and that'll be a very big new development in citizenship cases.
And so the whole issue around divided loyalties and risk of appearance of divided loyalties, isn't there, being worked out here?
Well, that's right. There is an argument that in the past in Britain, and certainly they were going back to pre-colonial, pre-federation laws, that you could actually be a dual citizen and be in Parliament. So the debate's been quite esoteric and detailed, but essentially it's all about whether these people had that dual citizenship, whether they did enough to know about it and whether they did enough to renounce it.
Okay, and just quickly, any indication when we'll know the result?
Susan Keith will wrap things up really quickly. She is the Chief Justice. She said, look, I appreciate that everyone wants a speedy judgment. It's not always possible in these circumstances. The next sitting day for the High Court is Tuesday at 10:15. One of the people here said some of the senior bureaucrats here in Canberra are being assembled here at the court at midday on Tuesday. Maybe that's a steer, maybe it's not. Parliament, of course, sitting next week. This will cause massive reverberations around Parliament House. Everyone turns their eyes here.
Indeed. Thanks very much, Matt. Matt Wordsworth at the High Court in Canberra today. Now, in a bid to address the affordability crisis in private health insurance, the federal government is set to announce a suite of changes that are being touted as the biggest in decades. The ABC can reveal today that discounts to get young people insured will be central. There is also acknowledgement of the rising need for better mental health care, with a new mental health safety net planned as part of standard coverage. Another big issue, of course, for consumers is knowing in advance exactly what they're covered for. So what measures are planned to improve transparency? The ABC's political editor Andrew Probyn has broken the story and he joined me earlier.
Well, on affordability, which is the critical issue, the key here for the government is to get premiums under control. Premiums in the past decade have been rising at 5 to 6%. Now, given that inflation is barely 2% some years in that period, this is a serious issue. And affordability, or the lack of affordability as it's seen by consumers, has seen the standard of coverage, the coverage across the nation, fall by 10,000 people per month. Young people, as you indicate, are the target audience of this new plan. They want to get young people in by in enticing them with discounts. Now, for the 19 to 29-year-old cohort, private funds will be offering discounts of 2% a year over 5, so it will build up to a maximum discount of 10% as a further inducement for these people to hang on to their cover. They will have a reduced premium for up to the age of 40. The other issue that has been targeted by both the funds and the federal government, who are both very keen on getting younger people in, is the focus on mental health. Now, mental health, the latest statistics show, is actually one of the issues that brings young women into hospitalisation, now above normal birth. By normal birth, I'm talking about non-caesarean birth. And private health institutions are responsible for a lot of the mental illness treatment. So mental health and discounts, the two key incentives here for younger people to take on private health insurance.
Now, what about so-called junk policies? It looks like they're staying. Tell us briefly what they are and why they're not being junked.
So-called junk policies are policies that are effectively taken out simply to avoid lifetime health cover, but also simply avoids the Medicare levy. Now, there has been a push in the past to remove junk policies or so-called junk policies from the system, but actuaries have provided advice that if you do that, then it would only see premiums increase across the whole sector. So junk policies are going to be allowed, or sort of low-cost policies are going to be allowed, but there is going to be an expectation that they do improve when it comes to mental health, for example.
Now, another big issue is transparency, just knowing what you're covered for and what you're not. Does the government have a magic bullet for that?
I don't know about magic bullet, but it's certainly going to have another go at transparency measures. We have in the order of 20 to 40,000 different health insurance policies out there. And when you're trying to sieve through all of those different products, of course, it's no one can. So the government and the funds have decided that they will have a gold, silver, bronze and basic category, under which all policies will have to fall.
So that's the ABC's political editor, Andrew Probyn, in Canberra. What's the view of the government's efforts from the Australian Medical Association? I spoke a short time ago to the AMA president, Michael Gannon.
Well, it's not going to solve it. It's perhaps a start in the right direction. The one thing the minister is up against, one thing that that future governments will be up against is the inevitable increase in the costs of healthcare. Health CPI runs at 4%, 5%, 6% per year. We're interested in some of the one-off savings that the minister is going to be able to achieve, but it's going to require ongoing work.
So what would it look like if the government was addressing the issue of the rising costs of healthcare?
The different players in the industry, the hospitals, the doctors, the insurers, need to continue to try and work with Minister Hunt on savings in the system. He's come up with some good ideas here. So, for example, he has managed to negotiate some savings with the people who manufacture prostheses. That's how he intends to deliver on cheaper hip replacements. But he's got cost control when it comes to doctors' fees. They've been in many ways frozen for nearly 5 years now. That's not the problem in the system. The biggest problem in the affordability of private health insurance is the amount that's going into the pockets of the for-profit insurers. Now, I've spoken to the minister about this. The genie's not going back in the bottle. Medibank Private's in private hands. The industry's now 60% for-profit. But somewhere on the line, we need some honesty in these discussions. We applaud the minister for trying to increase the size of the insurance pool. We need plenty of healthy people contributing to the insurance pool. But somewhere on the line, he's not going to be able to wave a magic wand. We need serious reform which addresses the simple fact that the costs will continue to increase year on year.
The other big issue, of course, is transparency, people just knowing what they're going to get when the unfortunate health event hits them. The government's proposing new categories, gold, silver, bronze and basic. Do you have any confidence that that will improve transparency?
Well, what's absolutely essential is that that we do so. There are too many tricks in the current system, too many carve-outs, too many caveats, too many people who find out they're not covered for the first time when they're actually sick. We went to the minister and said we want rid of junk policies. We're not overly excited about the idea of maintaining basic. But he came back to us and other stakeholders and said, look, we need to do something about affordability. So I think at least for now we're stuck with basic. But as long as people know what they're getting, as long as there's no tricks on clinical definitions, people shouldn't need to be 6 months into a medical degree to know what they're actually covered for. We want to see an end to policies that that only give cover in public hospitals. We want to see an end to the tricks and the games. But if there is some regulation about clinical definitions, if there is, very simply, if there are rules that stop the insurers selling a product and then when people actually get sick and want to use it being fine they're not covered, well then we will cautiously support the maintenance of basic. We want to see people know what they've paid for so that when they or their loved ones are sick they don't get a nasty surprise.
The AMA President Michael Gannon. Around Australia on ABC Radio, internationally on Radio Australia and streaming live from our website, this is PM. Don't forget you can listen on your tablet or mobile. Just make sure you download the ABC Listen app and keep up to date with us on Twitter and on Facebook, of course. Just search for ABC News. And if you missed the show, you can catch up on your podcast app. Search for PM. As the government tries to play down a huge data hack involving defence projects, the ABC can reveal that the cyber criminals also collected data on the ageing Collins-class submarines and the Navy's largest warships. Defence Industry Minister Christopher Pyne says the breach is disappointing. Stephanie Boris reports.
The list of what hackers stole from an Adelaide-based defence contractor is longer than previously thought. Aside from taking details about Australia's next generation of fighter jets and surveillance planes, the ABC can now reveal what other data they obtained. Information about the Collins-class submarines and our largest warships, HMAS Canberra and HMAS Adelaide, were also successfully hacked. Defence Industry Minister Christopher Pyne is playing down the significance of the breach.
The information that's been stolen is commercial information. It's not classified information, so it's not military information. And fortunately, the processes that we have in place have found this breach working with the primes, and it's being attended to.
But one cyber intelligence official has a different view on the incident. Mitchell Clark works for the Australian Signals Directorate. He was involved in investigating how the information was stolen.
The compromise was extensive and extreme, and as we'll see, most of that data was defence-related.
Hackers had access to the defence contractor's database for 5 months before the Australian Signals Directorate stepped in last year. Those behind the attack took 30 gigabytes of data, which included a diagram of one of the Navy's new ships. Mitchell Clark says the contractor involved in the breach only had one IT person and didn't do enough to protect itself from hackers.
Turns out the actor didn't even have to exploit the vulnerability. This thing, this service, when it was set up with default creds, and they'll never change. Admin got you into the web admin portal, and you could hit that from the internet. Guest as well, obviously.
Defence Industry Minister Christopher Pyne says the incident is a wake-up call for businesses working in the defence sector.
They will not get work in defence industry if their cybersecurity is not up to standard. So actually, while it's disappointing, I'm grateful that it's not as serious as if there were military breaches, but also I'm pleased in a way that it reminds Australian business of the dangers that lurk out there.
Minister Pyne insists there are no national security implications as a result of the breach, and he did everything he could to try and move on from questions about the incident.
I'm not going to have a big argument about this because today is actually a great day for Adelaide.
And that has opposition leader Bill Shorten fuming. He's accusing the government of not taking the breach seriously.
This government says, well, because the information wasn't too sensitive, it doesn't really matter. Well, maybe we just got lucky this time. I just don't want there to be a next time or a worse time. The government needs to smarten up its attitude.
Tom Uren is a cybersecurity expert currently working with the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. He says any type of breach isn't ideal, but says the compromised material was low level.
Anything involved in defence, you want to keep it as closely held as you can, but everything's relative. So there's some secrets that you really, really want to keep tightly held. And I guess just the recent news about the North Koreans stealing the South's plans, military plans, those are the kind of secrets that you want to wrap up so tightly that they never get out. But there's a lot of things in manufacturing where, just by the nature of what they're making, those parts get put on bombs or planes or ships, and they get sent out into the wide world. So it's impossible to say that, you know, the shape of those parts is a super secret.
It's not yet known who launched the attack. For now, the hacker has been given the name Alf after the iconic character from the TV show Home and Away. The ASD's Mitchell Clark says it was a sophisticated attack.
It's not just the old smash and grab that used to happen, you know, 5-6 years ago. It's much more methodical and slow and deliberate.
The government is not ruling out interference by a foreign state.
That report from our Canberra reporter Stephanie Boris. After much speculation, the US President Donald Trump is set to make an announcement on an overall Iran strategy in the coming day, the White House says. It's expected to include confirmation of whether he'll decertify the international deal that aims to curb Tehran's nuclear program. The president has branded the 2015 deal between Iran and six world powers an embarrassment. He is also expected to designate Iran's most powerful security force, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards, a terrorist organisation. Peter Lloyd reports.
It was at the United Nations General Assembly in New York last month that Donald Trump opened up on Iran, calling it a corrupt dictatorship behind the false guise of democracy, a rogue state whose chief exports are violence, bloodshed and chaos. And he signalled a rethink on US support for the 2015 nuclear deal.
The Iran deal was one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States has ever entered into. Frankly, that deal is an embarrassment to the United States, and I don't think you've heard the last of it, believe me.
The deal now in doubt was between Iran and the so-called P5 plus one. That's the US, UK, France, China, and Russia plus Germany. crippling economic sanctions on Iran were lifted in return for Iran limiting its sensitive nuclear R&D activities, reducing its uranium stockpile by 98% for 15 years, and agreeing to a regime of inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency. Iran was also banned from importing ballistic missile technology, but the deal said nothing of Iran's own ballistic missile program. Unstated was the hope that Iran would become more moderate, but in Congress, that's now viewed as a piece of grandiose optimism from the Obama era. So, what to do? Ed Royce, the Republican chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, reckons it's better to enforce the existing deal than walk away.
As flawed as the deal is, I believe we must now enforce the hell out of it. Let's work with allies to make certain that international inspectors have better access to possible nuclear sites, and we should address the fundamental sunset shortcoming, as our allies have recognized.
The same argument's being made by Democrats. This is Elliot Engel, another member of the Foreign Affairs Committee.
We in the United States have to live up to our word. If we withdraw from the deal now, Iran would be free today from the constraints on their program and the intrusive inspections. They could race headlong toward a nuclear bomb, hold all of the benefits of sanctions relief, and continue fomenting instability across the region. We need to work with allies and partners on a shared agenda that holds the regime in Tehran accountable, not dividing America from our closest friends across the globe.
But that seems the precise trajectory that Donald Trump is on. China and the European states in the deal are at one in demanding that the US stick to the agreement and work with allies on compliance. Germany's Foreign Minister Sigmar Gabriel.
Our big concern is that the security situation would get worse if the US rejects the Iran nuclear deal, and not better. We do not achieve a better security situation, but rather we are in danger of falling back to a time when Iran participated in the development of nuclear weapons, and there are new military dangers in the making there.
Russia's also on board with the status quo argument. This is Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov.
President Putin repeatedly mentioned the importance of existing agreements on the so-called Iran nuclear profile, and undoubtedly withdrawal of one of the countries from the agreement, especially such a key country as the United States, will definitely lead to negative consequences.
The Washington Post reports that Donald Trump threw a fit of anger in July when his top foreign policy team, including Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, told him to recertify the deal. Tillerson and National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, says the report, have come up with a plan to accommodate Trump's loathing of the deal without killing it outright. And a day ahead of the announcement, the president's keeping his cards close to his chest, but hinting that his dissatisfaction with Iran has a lot to do with North Korea.
I believe they're trading with North Korea. I believe they're doing things with North Korea that is totally inappropriate. That doesn't pertain to the deal, but in my opinion, it does, because it's called the spirit of a deal. And you will see what I will be doing in the not-too-distant future. But Iran is a bad player, and they will be taken care of as a bad player.
Another part of the Iran announcement could be a significant toughening of the U.S. approach to curbing Iranian influence in the Middle East. The elite Revolutionary Guards are at the vanguard of Iran's armed forces and have been heavily involved in propping up the regime of Bashar al-Assad in Syria at the same time as fending off Islamic State forces inside the country. The same has been true across the border in Iraq, where the best of Iran's forces have been part of the international effort to destroy Islamic State. Despite all that, Donald Trump is expected to designate Iran's most powerful security forces as a terrorist organization. Some believe that Donald Trump will be making the case that as Islamic State group is weakened, Iran is reasserting itself as the most destructive influence in the Middle East and using the nuclear deal as cover to do so.
Peter Lloyd reporting. Back home, and construction sites are risky workplaces, with 30 accidental deaths recorded last year. Well, now the Cancer Council is warning of another threat to tradies, an invisible one. Long-term exposure to silica dust is being linked to more than 200 lung cancer cases each year, and tradies are urged to be more vigilant in protecting their health at work. Antoinette Latouf reports.
Kelvin Quintal has been a form worker for 20 years. Today, he's leading a team of tradies at a large suburban construction site in Sydney.
What do you know about silica?
Silica? Nothing. Don't know anything about it.
And what are your biggest safety concerns when you're on a job site, if you think about your health long term?
Everything. Falls, trips, things falling on you, not really so much the dust.
Silica is found in stone, rock, sand, clay, as well as bricks, tiles and concrete, and some plastic materials. When these materials are worked on or cut, the fine dust that is released is called silica. Today, the Cancer Council revealed its findings into the long-term impacts of breathing it in. They're linking it to 230 lung cancer diagnoses each year. Here's Terry Slevin from Cancer Council Australia.
We estimate about 600,000 Australian workers are exposed to silica dust through the course of their work. The bottom line is that lung cancer is an awful disease where there's poor prognosis, and so the best lung cancer is one you don't get, and so preventing it's really important.
But tradesman Kelvin Quintal has no idea he's at risk.
From the job sites you've worked on and some of the tradies you've worked with, have you ever heard anybody talking about silica?
No, never. You're the first one.
Glazier Andrew Peter Murphy says because silica is out of sight, it's often also out of mind for many construction workers as well as their bosses.
There's no real measures. You know, we use dust masks and stuff like that, but you're still breathing it in. Obviously, it's getting in your face and in all that, so we wear glasses and masks and stuff like that, but it's in the air. So you can't see the fine particles in the air.
Cancer Council's Terry Slevin says most apprentices learn about silica during early training, but it's often never mentioned again.
Of course, apprenticeships occur mostly when people are younger, and when we're younger, we generally feel as though we're pretty invulnerable. And those lessons are sometimes forgotten. So I guess the objective of the Cancer Council is to ensure that people hear it through other channels and people hear it from people like us rather than just through a workplace, and maybe their mum or their sister or their wife. And if you get some kind of recognition through other sources of information, that further reinforces the importance of protecting your lungs in this way.
But even Vince Ball from the Construction Industry Training Council, a body that advises on OH&S training issues, didn't expect these results.
I think some of the surprise would be on the numbers, one that I think is really not taken enough notice of. Maybe it's an area that we should look at a little bit more closely, particularly with some developing some awareness programs and promoting it a lot better than what's happening at the moment.
And he says given the education campaigns to curtail unnecessary exposure to asbestos, job sites are getting stricter on safety measures and protective gear.
I think generally, and it's only generally, people and workers and tradies working in that area and working with those materials certainly have a lot better understanding of wearing appropriate breathing apparatus. That is generally. I think the hardest market of the lot are the do-it-yourselfers and the mums and dads and others at homes doing that work around there with very little protection.
The truth is weekend warriors are far less likely to be exposed than the two young tradies that you talked about. I mean, those guys are there probably 40 or more hours a week for 48 weeks a year. But even if you are knocking over an occasional bathroom, doing some work, fixing a brick fence or whatever else it might be, it's still exposure to your lungs that you don't want to have.
Protecting against silica exposure includes wearing a dust mask, adequate on-site ventilation, as well as using specialised tools with appropriate blades and dust suppression features.
Antoinette Latouf reporting. Amid perpetual concern about retirement incomes, there's more worrying news from an international survey. It shows that more than half of working adults in the UK, the US and Australia expect to live a poor or modest lifestyle in retirement. Alarmingly, the study also shows the gap between the number of men and the number of women who are prepared for retirement is widest in Australia, with single women facing the most precarious outlook. David Taylor has been looking at the findings.
How would you cope if your income was slashed? That's what's facing millions of Australians approaching retirement.
It's, I dare say, the source of a lot of stress and anguish for many people in that position.
That's independent economist Saul Eslake. The Retirement Readiness Report was prepared by the Actuaries Institute Australia, the American Academy of Actuaries, and the UK's Institute and Faculty of Actuaries. Close to 3,000 working men and women aged between 18 and 64 were asked how prepared they were to retire. The majority of respondents didn't know how much money they'd need to retire, how long long the money they expect to have will last, or what will happen if they're forced to stop working unexpectedly. Kath Nance is a partner at accounting firm PricewaterhouseCoopers and a member of the Actuaries Institute.
One in five, only one in five, expect to fully retire these days. One third do not expect to retire at all. One half.
So work till you drop, basically.
Work till you drop, exactly. And that's probably been the biggest change.
The survey found just 22% of Australian women are prepared to retire, compared to 47% of men. Indeed, the difference between the number of men on track to retire comfortably compared to women is greatest among Australians.
There's nothing that's really been done about it yet, but some of the things that, you know, they are looking at doing is removing the exemption for super guarantee. If you earn less than $450 a month, you don't get superannuation guarantee paid, and a lot more women feature in that category than men. So there's things like that that they are looking at.
Do you think some women would be shocked by some of these findings?
I don't think they'd be shocked, because I think a lot of women would see that they have hardly any superannuation themselves. You know, like the median superannuation savings is something like about 80,000 for men, 70 or 80,000 for men, and about half that for women, 40,000.
So at what age?
That's the median across all people that are saving. The median retirement amounts are 100,000 for men and 28,000 for women.
That's nothing.
It's nothing. That's right. So I don't think women would be shocked. I think that's,
I mean, you could only retire for 6 months on that.
Oh, yes, exactly.
Saul Eslake again.
Women typically earn less than men while they're working. And second, the fact that women's careers are much more likely to be interrupted by periods of having or caring for children, and in many cases for elderly relatives, than is the case with men.
The survey found single women are the least prepared for retirement. Independent economist Saul Eslake blames the sharp rise in the number of retired Australians left out of pocket on the move away from defined super benefit schemes towards lump sum payments, which in turn needs to be invested. He says most Australians haven't got a clue how to manage money at a professional level.
Those are risks which most individuals are not well equipped to assess and manage.
Which is why the defined benefit scheme was so important.
Yes, indeed, and why they were also fairly expensive for employers to operate. So that's been a major motivating factor, albeit one not widely advertised, for the movement away from defined benefit schemes to defined contribution schemes. It's a major transfer of risk.
The Actuaries Institute is calling for more education around how to prepare for retirement, including improved financial literacy and access to financial planning.
David Taylor reporting. An 85-year-old Buddhist intellectual in Thailand is facing 15 years in jail for questioning the historical accuracy of a revered story about a former Thai king who is said to have slayed a Burmese prince in a duel while riding elephants. Unfortunately for the man in question, the story is also held dear by key figures in the military, and the military currently runs the country. The intellectual has been charged under Thailand's notoriously harsh law against royal defamation, sparking debate about whether the law should cover dead kings. From Bangkok, here's Southeast Asia correspondent Liam Cochran.
It's a scene made for the movies. A warrior king, a clash of elephants, a decisive victory. Historian Chris Baker recounts the popular version of the great elephant duel between Thai King Naraswan and Burmese Prince Mingye Swa in 1593.
Duel on elephant back was supposed to be the height of warfare at that time. You know, it's a bit like when knights used to joust. So it's very romantic. Naraswan challenges the Burmese prince to the duel and then defeats him and kills him, and that's very clear. And that then the Burmese are just driven away from Ayutthaya and back to Burma.
Fast forward 421 years, Burma is now known as Myanmar, while Siam is now Thailand. In 2014, one of Thailand's best-known intellectuals, Sulak Sivaraksa, mentions the elephant battle while speaking at a university seminar. He asks the audience to think critically about the historic depiction of the event. Days later, two retired soldiers make a formal complaint that Mr. Sulak breached Thailand's Les Majesty laws, designed to protect the monarchy from criticism. Sulak Sivaraksa says he was just following standard academic procedure.
My point is that, you know, if you want to learn history, you have to get all facts from the past as much as you can. And I just state the facts.
Mr. Sulak was charged back then, but it's apparently taken the police 3 years to investigate. This week, police escorted the 85-year-old, who walks with the help of a cane, to the prosecutor's office. The prosecutor will now decide whether to push ahead with the case. If so, it will be held in a military court, possibly in secret, says Mr. Sulak.
So I'm at the mercy of the military tribunal. If they want to be fair, if they want to be sincere, I get acquitted. But if they want to punish me, well, what can you do? There's no rule of law.
So why now?
Well, I wish I knew. The country is run by dictatorship. So there's no regard for the rule of law. And for the army, King Naresuan is a great hero, see? And the elephant combat is real for them. It's our victory because we were defeated by the Burmese so often. And this is our great victory.
Sulak Sivaraksa isn't the only one to question exactly what happened when the elephants clashed. Chris Baker has just released a book about this period of Thai history, so the source material is fresh in his mind.
There's around 10 different accounts of the incident. And it's important to state at the beginning that not one of these claims to be an eyewitness account. No one has said, I saw it and this is what happens. So these are all just kind of stories about an event, not eyewitness accounts. And these are all different. Every single one of these is different. Not two of them are the same. And they differ about every single detail of the thing. Where it took place is a matter of some debate. Then there is a question of whether there was a duel or not, whether it was a formal duel, whether Narisuan challenged the Burmese prince, or in some accounts, it's simply they just met in the middle of the battle and fought against one another. More importantly, there's a question, there's big differences in how he is killed. The mainstream version, Narisuan kills him with a sword. In other versions, the Burmese prince is killed with a bullet.
Besides the question of historical accuracy, there's the application of the Lese Majesty law, which protects the king, queen, heir and regent from slander, but is now being used to shield dead kings too. Here's Chris Baker.
It's a law that's very difficult to understand these days. We used to think it was pretty simple in that it identified exactly who were the personages who could be insulted and therefore the law could be invoked. But it now seems to be much broader than that, and I think it's very difficult to understand now.
Sulak Sivaraksa has faced down Lese Majesty accusations in the past and has this message for Australia.
I just want to appeal to our listeners all over the world. If they care for justice, care for human rights, they should write to the foreign ministry, the Thai foreign ministry, arguing that this country should respect rule of law. And Mr. Sulak is an old man, 85 years old, and he had done nothing wrong. He does not deserve to spend 15 years in jail.
On the 7th of December, the prosecutor will decide whether the case will go to a military tribunal. This is Liam Cochran in Bangkok, reporting for PM.
The West African nation of Liberia will tonight know the outcome of its third national election since the country ended a violent civil war in 2003. It also marks the end of the leadership of the first woman elected to lead a government in Africa, Nobel Prize winner Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who presided over an impressive revival for her country, but is strangely unpopular internally. As importantly, it will be the first time in over 70 years that one democratically elected Liberian leader will hand power to another. But while hopes for continued peace in Liberia are pretty solid, there is also the shadow of the influence of convicted war criminal and former president Charles Taylor, and voting irregularities are causing disquiet. Rodney Sear is the editor of the Liberian news outlet Front Page Africa. He says the election did not go as smoothly as was hoped.
Some places where voters went to cast their ballots and they were told that their names were not on the voter roll. So a lot of them were angry. In fact, I was in a town called Batala Bon County, the former stronghold of former President Charles Taylor. And a lot of voters were there complaining that they were not allowed to vote. In fact, as early as the morning hours, some of them blocked a main entrance in the town, put tires on the middle of the road and put fire around it, and demanded that they were not allowed to vote and needed to vote.
You mentioned Charles Taylor, the former president. He's currently serving a 50-year jail sentence for war crimes. That's in the UK. Earlier this year, though, he recorded a phone conversation from his high-security prison. It was broadcast to supporters. What was the message he wanted to put to them?
Well, I think the message was that he has not abandoned them and that they all should support the party, the National Patriotic Party, which was the political arm of his military rebel movement. And it caused a lot of nervousness among people, you know, when that recording came out.
How much support does Charles Taylor still have in Liberia?
Especially in the areas where he controlled when he was here, people still see him as some kind of savior. So a lot of people pay attention to what he did, and they have a lot of respect for him. A lot of people are saying that if he was running for president, they will support his candidacy.
Regardless of the fact that he's been jailed for war crimes.
Oh, yeah. A lot of people still feel that way. Those who lost friends, relatives, and loved ones in the war, they're not happy about it, but there are people who benefited from him when he was in power who feel that, you know, he should be allowed to come back.
Charles Taylor's ex-wife, Jewel Howard Taylor, is running in the election on the presidential ticket of the former football star George Weah. Is there a concern that she might be trying to act as Charles Taylor's proxy to promote his cause through the election?
She did do some interviews and made some speeches in the moment, days leading toward the elections, where she said that the Taylor agenda would be back on the table if her ticket was successful. And a lot of people are, you know, were not happy with that. She made this comment without any providing the details. But all she said that the agenda will be back on the table. So people are concerned about it, and they're not sure what she actually meant about that.
And so who is likely to be victorious in terms of your assessment of the lie of the land and in terms of any indications you might have had from the actual poll?
Initial vote counting is still underway, but from what we've heard from the early readings, it appears that we may be heading to a runoff between Vice President Joseph Boakai and the football legend Senator George Mane Weah. It's still early, but I think that's how it's shaping up to be.
And given that we're still waiting to see, what would it mean for Liberia, for either of those candidates to take power?
Well, you know, Liberia has been had some issues prior to the civil war, where one party dominated the country. So many analysts and political observers are concerned that if the ruling party stays in power for 12 more years, it might cement some kind of dictatorial or dictatorship in the country once more. We, on the other hand, he still lacks some experience, some political experience. It remains to be seen whether either of them can be the change candidate that Liberia really needs at this time.
From Liberia, Rodney Sear, the editor of the Liberian news outlet Front Page Africa. That's PM for this evening. I'm Linda Mottram. Thank you for your company. Sabra Lane is here in the morning with AM and Thomas Ariti at midday with The World Today. I look forward to your company at the same time tomorrow. Stay listening now, though. Elise Morgan is here with Business PM.
Thanks, Linda. Coming up on Business PM, a bank boss pours doubt on whether interest rates will rise early next year, as many predict. But first, the apartment oversupply in Australia's major East Coast capital cities is firmly on the Reserve Bank's radar, with a number of key officials recently singling out Brisbane as a particular concern. Unit values there are lower than they were a decade ago, and are tipped to fall further as more and more stock comes onto the market. A further 41,000 apartments are tipped to be completed across the city in the next 2 years, and that's putting intense pressure on sale prices. Here's Rebecca Hyam.
Lisa Foley and her husband bought their first home in the sought-after inner-city suburb of New Farm in 2011. It was an older-style, two-bedroom, one-bathroom brick unit in a complex of about 40. But the location, on one of the suburb's best, leafiest streets, was hard to beat. When it came time to sell that unit earlier this year, the full force of Brisbane's apartment downturn hit home.
We purchased the unit in 2011 and we purchased it for $432,000.
How much did you advertise it for to sell?
To begin with, it was high 400s, and then we brought that down to offers around the mid 400s, and then we ultimately sold it for $430,000.
She says when they moved into their first home, the idea that it would sit on the market for 3.5 months and sell at a loss just 6 years later was unfathomable.
We knew it was an older style unit. We did invest some money in it before we sold it. So we put some new carpets in, we repainted, we did a little bit of work to the kitchen and bathroom. So we did put money in as well, but we thought we would be safe because it was on Moray Street in New Farm.
It is surprising. New Farm is a really highly desirable suburb. It's inner city. It doesn't have any of the supply concerns that you'd find in, say, a Fortitude Valley or a South Brisbane or West End. But when you look at the overall Brisbane marketplace, we've seen negative growth over the past decade.
That's Tim Lawless, the head of research at the property data group CoreLogic. He says unit values are set to come under further downward pressure over the next 2 years because Brisbane will have added about a fifth more apartments in that time.
It's never been this high. In fact, it's about double the long-term average at the moment. So the next 2 years, we're expecting about 41,000 units to be completed across the broader Brisbane metro region. And that's about a 21% uplift compared with existing stock levels.
So how does that compare to other cities where oversupply concerns have been raised? Tim Lawless again.
Melbourne's actually seeing a larger raw number of units, but that city's well along the densification path, and the uplift in total stock is only about 15%. And then you've got Sydney, where there's about 95,000 units about to come online in the next 2 years. That's only a 12% uplift in stocks.
Unlike Brisbane, in the last few years, those cities have also benefited from stronger population growth and flourishing state economies, which have helped to shore up demand for new high-density residential developments. Lisa Foley says Brisbane's apartment construction boom crippled the sale of her first home.
I'm no expert, but I'd have to think that was the biggest problem for us. And even where I live in Cooperoo now, there are developments everywhere for new units and they're selling for less than we purchased our 80s style New Farm unit for.
Tim Lawless suggests early signs of improving jobs growth in Queensland and the severe housing affordability constraints in Sydney could help resurrect the Brisbane unit market, but he warns it'll take some time.
Typical house value in Sydney is just over $1 million. It's $1.74 million, whereas in Brisbane, it's just over $500,000. So you can understand why people in Sydney will be cashing out of the marketplace and moving towards southeast Queensland.
CoreLogic's head of research, Tim Lawless, ending that report by Rebecca Hyam. The Bank of Queensland reported its results today, and thanks to a pickup in business and home loan lending and a drop in bad debts, it recorded a 4% lift in full-year earnings. The bank's chief executive, John Sutton, says he's comfortable with the health of the bank's loan portfolio and said the bank's exposure to the Brisbane apartment market was limited. The bank's so confident in the outlook it's rewarding shareholders with a special dividend of 8 cents a share. CEO John Sutton also poured doubt on the market's belief that the Reserve Bank will be raising rates in the first half of next year. I spoke with him earlier. John Sutton, a pickup in lending helped lift the result. How long do you expect that pickup to continue?
Well, certainly we had a very strong second half across all of our business lines, and most pleasing was Virgin Money, which picked up $700 million since we released the product. Our commercial business, particularly in our niche businesses, had very strong lending growth. Certainly we're a little bit cautious about home loan growth. I feel that the system or credit growth for the system will actually moderate, particularly given the two macroprudential changes that have been in place for some time, will slow growth.
The regulator has really focused on it. ASIC's latest report on lending shows that big banks did pull back on interest only, but that smaller lenders, which BOQ comes into, picked up
a little bit in interest-only lending. Why do you think that is?
We are well under the caps that have been mandated by the regulator, and we are seeing a moderation in interest-only lending. I actually think, and we're hearing from brokers, that the demand from the general consumer is slowing on interest only.
Because ASIC also found that borrowers who use brokers are more likely to go for an interest only loan. Do you think there needs to be more scrutiny of brokers and their role in this?
We actually validate every single loan that comes in, whether it's through a broker or whether it's through the branch, to ensure that we meet those standards. I actually think that with a lot of the discussion that's in the community about interest only versus P&I, and what regulators are talking about, is we are seeing customers, particularly at these lower interest rates, actually move to P&I.
If you're validating every loan that comes through, you obviously want to make sure that they're right. Not every bank and institution is doing that. Do you think that that potentially causes risk to financial stability if not every bank is doing that?
I think in terms of financial stability, and I can't comment on what other bank practices are, I can only comment on what we do. So we take a conservative approach. But I think all of us in the banking industry, you've seen strong housing growth over the last few years. Mortgage repayments are ahead of schedule for nearly all of the banks. I'm sure for all of the banks, and we're also seeing the low interest rates is also helping as well. So I don't see any systemic risk in the mortgage market. But what you do have to do is to make sure that we think about where consumers are and when the inevitable fact happens that official cash rates may move in the future, that borrowers are able to make those repayments.
We're now at a time where we're expecting the Reserve Bank to raise rates within the next couple of months, really. What do you think is going to be the impact on consumer and business behaviour when that rate rise cycle starts?
I don't necessarily believe that the Reserve Bank's going to raise rates in the next 2 months.
Not next 2 months, but in the first half of next year.
Again, I'm not so sure whether the Reserve Bank would do that. But I think that if you look around the world, quantitative easing is starting to slow, and central bankers are talking about raising rates. I don't think we can sit back here and actually really think that historically low cash rate is here forever. And in our own mind, and businesses' mind and consumers' mind, you need to plan for the eventuality that rates will rise. I think from our perspective at BOQ, we're well prepared for that, and our customers are well prepared for that.
When do you think the RBA will move then, if you don't believe it will be the first half of next year? Because there's a lot of economists who believe it will be the first half of next year.
Elise, I have a terrible track record on picking exchange rate movements and when official rates will move. I'm sure the RBA will weigh a number of factors in that rate decision. That's probably about where the currency is, what other central banks are doing, and what activity levels you're certainly seeing in the Australian economy. And I have every faith that the RBA will make the right decision at the right time on rates.
When they go up by 25 basis points, do you think it will be well and truly all passed on to consumers? Is competition tough enough that banks will be trying to undercut each other on that?
I have no idea about what other banks would or wouldn't do, and I would not make any comment about what we may or may not do. But what I will say at the moment is that there is intense competition at the moment in the home loan mortgage market, particularly for the lower LVR P&I loans.
John Sutton, thank you so much for joining the program.
Thank you very much, Elise.
The share market staged a late rally. The ASX 200 closed 0.4% higher. The takeover of local hotel giant Mantra by the French-owned Accor Group is one step closer after the board of Mantra today agreed to the $1.2 billion offer. It now has to go through regulatory approval. The Australian dollar is building on earlier gains. A short time ago, it was buying 78.2 US cents. And that's all for Business PM. I'm Elise Morgan. Good night.